Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Our friend Adam Morrow is going to be back on the phone, live from Egypt, from Cairo. He'll be reporting on what the hell's going on. It's been a year already since the counter-revolution in Egypt, and a lot to catch up on. Well, we've been talking with him the whole time, of course. Been talking with Adam since the beginning of the Arab Spring. January, could have been February. I think it was probably January of 2011. And anyway, here we are already a year out from the military coup d'etat that overthrew the elected government there. And got some kooks flying ISIS flags in the Sinai, and plenty to talk about with Adam Morrow later on the show. Also, Ray McGovern will be here to talk about America's sock puppet coup d'etat government in Ukraine. And, geez, according to Ray, we'll have to discuss America's refusal to go along with European efforts to go ahead and compromise and try to make peace here. Escalation of the conflict remains America's policy. So Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst on the USSR, will be here on the show to talk about his new one on America, Europe, Russia, and Ukraine. And oh, where the hell's the other one? I got so many articles here, I lose track of them all. And I have a couple of more invites out, and maybe we'll hear from them people, and maybe we won't. Yeah, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. You can find all my archives at scotthorton.org. I should say that first. At scotthorton.org, you can find more than 3,000 interviews that I've done, dating back till, well, right around this time, 2003. scotthorton.org. And you can find my whole show archives, many of them anyway. You can find articles I wrote. Join up the chat room. Every day live during the show, we got, well, I admit, not a very strong presence in the chat room thus far today. Sometimes it gets going pretty good. Maybe I should mention it more often. Chat room, chat room, chat room. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat, and you don't have to have any kind of external program on your boss's computer's browser or anything like that. You just go to scotthorton.org/chat, make up a fake name, put in a CAPTCHA, and you're in. So you don't need instant messenger program or Pigeon or XChat or any of that kind of thing. Just go. Oh, man. All right. I had quite a few no's today. I was trying to get this lady who was the former spokeswoman for the PLO. And she's now a professor of whatever the hell at Harvard. And I missed it, but Eric Garris, that is, from antiwar.com, he says he saw her on CNN yesterday. And get this, this is actually, should be the top news. CNN let a lady who knew what she was talking about and was good at talking about it criticize the Israeli narrative about what was going on with all the raids in Gaza, the bombings in Gaza, and the raids in the West Bank and the rest of it. And according to Eric, this went on for 10 minutes or something. They basically, they played all their stock footage and all their stock commentary and whatever, and then, but they just let her chime in. And he said one example was, well, you know, how can anyone be expected to talk to the PLA when you're in a coalition government, when they are in a coalition government with Hamas? And she says, all right, well, but what if I say, yeah, but the Likud party is in a coalition with Yisrael Betanu and some of these other further to the right factions who, you know, by no means respect the Palestinians' right to exist. You can always find an excuse to not engage in discussion. Anyway, and that was just one example of her having an actual argument against all the stock propaganda that usually is, you know, no one has a chance on CNN to criticize the Israeli position, which then, of course, is immediately translated into the American position, their narrative on what's taking place and why. Anyway, so I just thought it'd be nice to... I'm not very good at having Palestinians on just because, most of the best critics of American and Israeli policy that I know are Jewish liberals. But that's mostly just because I'm lazy. You know, Max Blumenthal and Phil Weiss, and I know that they have a little war going on with MJ Rosenberg, but I like MJ too, and whatever, man, those guys. But, you know, I talk with Dean Ahmad from time to time, talk with Ramzi Baroud. I like Ramzi Baroud. We write, we publish him at antiwar.com pretty often. I need to do a better job of interviewing Palestinians, certainly, on this show. So anyway, hopefully in the future. Her name is Batu. I'm sorry, I forget. I had it in front of me a minute ago. Diana Batu or Butu or something. Anyway, working on that, maybe next week. They're at the Institute for Middle East Understanding. All right, well, whatever that is. Working on that. And then I'm trying to get someone from Code Pink because I don't know who else is an anti-war anything group. Who's an anti-war group who's leading some protests? Who's putting together the big rally in D.C.? Who's stopping the Iraq war? Somebody stop the Iraq war. And going back in there, can you imagine if it was George W. Bush going back into Iraq right now? Oh my God. The anger that the liberals would be pretending to feel. That outrage that would consume them, you know, upon word from each other that that's how they're supposed to act and pretend to care. But Obama wants to reinvade Iraq. Anyway, let's talk about the Hobby Lobby some more. The Hobby Lobby. Anyway, there's the wars going on, and that's more important. That's the most important. All right, now, so I got a lot of news to cover before we get to the interviews, so I'm kind of glad that I haven't gotten a whole bunch of answers. Fill up all of my talking time with other people talking. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and spend the last just couple of minutes of this segment on the NSA today, because I don't know what all to say about it. But I have some stories here, and I want to make sure you know about them. First of all, breaking this morning, and this is really huge. And in fact, I will admit to you, because it occurs to me, I just don't know enough to know just how big of a deal this is. But boy, does this sound like a big deal to me, guys. According to Cory Doctorow, he's a serious journalist. Doesn't sound like it, but boingboing.com is very serious. And he has gone through with the X key score. Oh, there's a new shocking story on a German website that Jacob Applebaum helped write, along with a guy named John Goetz and a lady named Lena Kampf. And anyway, so check it out. These are the X key score rules for who gets targeted. And the X key score rules for who gets targeted is anyone who has ever searched or read anything about Tor. What do they keep? What doesn't get flushed out of their buffer? What do they keep forever is anything that they get about anyone who even searches for Tor or for Tales. Which may include you listening to me mention that right now. I don't know how that works. But the way they headline it at Boing Boing is, if you read Boing Boing, the NSA considers you a target for deep surveillance. If you've ever even looked into Tor, they got your ass. Read about it at boingboing.net right now. It's at the top of antiwar.com as well. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right. Now I'm going to talk more about the NSA. Cory Doctorow. here he is at Boing Boing. If you read Boing Boing, it's a technology website. If you read Boing Boing, the NSA considers you a target for deep surveillance, which is a nice self-promotional way of saying, if you know anything about computer security, and you have ever engaged in any deliberate methods of securing your privacy on the internet, then they are targeting you for deep packet inspection. Here, let me page down to the good stuff. Again, it's at boingboing.net. According to the story, the NSA targets anyone who searches for online articles about tales, like this one that we published in April, or this article for teens that I wrote in May, or Tor, the Onion router, which we've been posting about since 2004. Anyone who is determined to be using, to be using Tor is also targeted for long-term surveillance and retention. Tor and Tails have been part of the mainstream discussion of online security, surveillance, and privacy for years. It's nothing short of bizarre to place people under suspicion for searching these terms. More importantly, this shows that the NSA uses, quote, targeted surveillance in a way that beggars common sense. It is a dead certainty that people who heard the NSA's reassurance about targeting its surveillance on people who were doing something suspicious didn't understand that the NSA meant people who looked up technical details about systems that are routinely discussed on the front page of every newspaper in the world. And then, okay, gets into, you know, their wordsmithing and dishonesty. I've known that this story was coming for some time now, writes Doctorow, having learned about its broad contours under embargo from a trusted source. Since then, I've discussed it in confidence with some of the technical experts who have worked on the full set of Snowden docs, and they were as shocked as I was. One expert suggested that the NSA's intention here was to separate the sheep from the goats, to split the entire population of the internet into people who have the technical know-how to be private and people who don't, and then capture all the communications from the first group. Another expert said that he or she believed that this leak may have come from a second source, not Edward Snowden, as he or she had not seen this in the original Snowden docs and had seen other revelations that also appeared independent of the Snowden materials. If that's true, it's big news, as Snowden was the first person to ever leak docs from the NSA. The existence of a potential second source means that Snowden may have inspired some of his former colleagues to take a long, hard look at the agency's cavalier attitude to the law and decency. Here, wow, wouldn't that be great? That would be the biggest story in here if there really was a second whistleblower, maybe still inside the NSA. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, but here. And you know what? This was in the original Prism story, wasn't it? Or in one of the original stories a year ago. That anyone who uses anything encrypted is kept. And just as well as they said, anything that seems to indicate criminal activity. Even things that have nothing to do with the NSA's charter. Which could be as, you know, broad as somebody selling somebody else a dime bag of weed or whatever. Right? They can keep whatever they want. Anything encrypted. Even looking into, even Googling, how would I go about encrypting my email would mean, blam, you are on their target list forever now for deep packet inspection of all your web searching. Holy, really? I tried to get Dr. O on the show today to talk about this, and he was unavailable. Traveling. But this guy, he's a serious serious technology journalist here, and that doesn't mean that he's correct, but it means that, you know, he's no goofball, and he's not the kind of guy who would get something like this wrong deliberately or cavalierly anyway. I mean, that doesn't mean he's 100% right, but it does mean take this seriously. And you know what? I'm not seeing anyone complain that they don't think this is right on Twitter so far anyway. And here he talks about, he has another screenshot, he says on Twitter, again, it's Cory Doctorow, just like doctor with an O-W on the end. And he's on Twitter here, he's saying, yeah, look at that, NSA has a selector for people visiting linuxjournal.com. So, separating the sheep from the goats. Anyone who knows enough to attempt to be private online knows too much to be innocent, I guess, from the NSA's point of view. Huge. And now here's the other one, and I haven't even read this thing yet, man. I got the tab open, and I hadn't got to it, but it's new Barton Gellman in the Washington Post, new as in 2 days ago. Court gave NSA broad leeway in surveillance, documents show. And I actually had talked with our guest yesterday about whether I could ask her about this, but we just didn't have time. Probably because I asked the same stupid question a couple of times and wasted time. But anyway, she was great, wasn't she? Forgot her name all of a sudden again. Anyway, court gave NSA broad leeway in surveillance, and then they came out with the list of the foreign governments and organizations authorized for surveillance. And get this, it's 193 governments in the world, which I thought there were only 192. And I knew that, like, since then, okay, they've broken off South Sudan, the CIA, that is, the U.S. Empire, has broken off South Sudan, so that happened. But then, and Kosovo, I guess, declared independence since I last counted. But anyway, they're saying that, I believe they're claiming here, that the Five Eyes are exempt. So is that right? There are 198 countries in the world now? I don't know. Anyway, everybody else on Earth, they're all completely up for grabs. Every bit of their electronic communication is unprotected by any law. Well, I don't know. Apparently. Again, I sent the Washington Post. Barton Gellman, he does good work there. I know their editorial page is the center of all evil on the planet Earth, but the Gellman does good work. All right. Opposition to NSA surveillance unites conservatives and solid liberals. This is a poll from Pew. This is the establishment. You hear ads for their foundation if you listen to NPR radio, right? That's who Pew is. Or one of these, like the Guggenheim or the Ford Foundation or the center of the American establishment. They're behind this poll that says that anybody who believes anything is against this. Bunch of know-nothing idiots and security moms and whoever else can be frightened into it. Hardcore right-wingers, I guess. National security state right-wingers. But, you know, Obama's in charge of it all. And so can you get them to say even with Obama at the reins of it all? It's harder that way. Disapproval. Here, according to the Pew. And still waiting on the big one at The Intercept. Hurry up, Glenn. We'll be right back, y'all. ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. Hey, y'all. How are things going? Good. Okay, good. Ray McGovern's coming up to talk about America's sock puppet regime in Ukraine. Continued warring in the East. Adam Morrow will be on to talk about America's sock puppet dictatorship in Egypt. All the consequences of that. And then I'm still waiting to hear back from a couple of people. Might could hear from them, might not. But I got lots of news to cover here. I'm going to get to Israel and this lynching and all that here in a minute. But first, Somalia. Where's my Somalia story here? Come here, your Somalia story. Reuters, exclusive. U.S. discloses secret Somalia military presence. Up to 120 troops. U.S. military advisors have been secretly operating in Somalia since around 2007. And Washington plans to deepen its security assistance to help the country fend off threats by Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The comments are the first detailed public acknowledgement of U.S. military presence in Somalia dating back since the U.S. administration of George W. Bush, and add to other signs of deepening U.S. commitment to Somalia's government, which the Obama administration recognized last year. The deployments, consisting of up to 120 troops on the ground, go beyond the Pentagon's January announcement that it had sent a handful of advisors in October. That was seen at the time as the first assignment of U.S. troops to Somalia. No, it was not seen as that. Give me a break, Reuters. Why don't you go back and read Reuters from December 2006 and January, February, March 2007, when the CIA and the military were there helping the Ethiopian army invade. Idiots. Black Hawk down in 1993. Get the F out of here. The plans to further expand U.S. military assistance coincide with increasing efforts by the Somali government and African Union peacekeepers to counter a bloody 7-year insurgent campaign by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab to impose strict Islamic law inside Somalia. Those U.S. plans include greater military engagement and new funds for training an assistant for the Somali National Army after years of working with the African National Mission, African Union Mission in Somalia, or ANASOM, which has about 22,000 troops in the country from Uganda, Kenya, Sierra Leone, Burundi, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. Djibouti, too, huh? Has troops in Somalia? What you'll see with this upcoming fiscal year is the beginning of engagement with the SNA proper. That's the Syrian, or the Somali National Army, said U.S. defense official who declined to be identified. The next fiscal year starts in October. The Obama administration official told Reuters there were currently up to 120 U.S. military personnel on the ground throughout Somalia and described them as trainers and advisors. They're not involved in combat, the official told Reuters, speaking on condition of anonymity, adding that until last year, U.S. military advisors had been working with AMISOM troop contributors, as opposed to Somali forces. So that's what's changed. They were just training the African Union. Now they're training the so-called Somali army. Supposedly, that's the difference. Obama last year determined Somalia could receive U.S. military assistance. Another official said American forces over the years have provided advice and assistance in areas relating to mission planning, small unit tactics, medical care, human rights, and communications. Human rights. Officials said U.S. forces in Somalia have also facilitated coordination, planning, and communication between AMISOM troop contributors and Somali security forces. The comments expand upon a little-noticed section of a speech given early in June by Wendy Sherman, Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs. It was mentioned here, although not in much detail, I guess. She publicly acknowledged the small contingent of U.S. military personnel, including Special Operations Forces, had been present in Somalia for several years. Still, it was not immediately clear from her remarks the extent to which U.S. personnel had been operating. I love how whoever wrote this did no research whatsoever to see if anybody else has done any journalism about this before. Good job, guys. There aren't two massive tomes published about this in the last year or anything that you could read. Still, it was not immediately clear from her remarks the extent to which U.S. personnel have been operating. U.S. Special Operations Forces have staged high-profile raids in the past in Somalia, including an aborted attempt in October to capture an Al-Shabaab operative in the militant group's stronghold of Barawe. U.S. officials have acknowledged Washington's support for AMISOM and Somalia's struggle against Al-Shabaab. U.S. CIA officials have been known to operate in the country. U.S. troop numbers on the ground in Somalia vary over time, the officials told Reuters. Deployments are staggered and short-term, one official said. But the Obama administration official added that there was overlap in the deployments to allow for a persistent presence on the ground. Asked about where U.S. forces were deployed, the administration official said they were in locations throughout Somalia, but declined to elaborate further for security reasons. The official declined to say precisely when the first U.S. military forces went back into Somalia, saying it was around 2007. Again, they did no research. They have no idea whether this could be true or not. That's all they have. Well, an anonymous official said something. Great job, guys, on this. Asked about why Sherman chose to disclose the information, a State Department official told Reuters, in the past, our assessment of the security situation in Somalia informed our decision. Yeah. Anyway, so there you go. Sorry for going on so long. More escalation in Somalia. The U.S. has made it this way all along. It's in the WikiLeaks as heroically liberated by Chelsea Manning, as extrapolated upon by Rob Prince at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. America really forced Meles Zenawi, the dictator of Ethiopia, who's now dead, to do the invasion. He didn't even want to do it. And they said, look, we need you to do this for us. And it made it an offer he couldn't refuse. And so it was George Bush's project from the very beginning. And then I'll skip a bunch of steps because I don't have time in this segment, but I'll get to the part where, after years of war in 2008, Condoleezza Rice, almost two full years of war, toward the end of 2008, after the Al-Shabaab movement had grown up from nothing into a force powerful enough to expel the Ethiopian invaders, Condoleezza Rice came to the table and put the guys that the invasion was meant to overthrow right back in power. A guy named Sheikh Sharif among them, and he ended up staying in power until 2012. And it's in Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars, on page 222, that the State Department spokeslady, or whoever, undersecretary for killing people and telling lies or accidentally admitting things or whatever her name is, says, you know, we meant to keep Sheikh Sharif all along. All we wanted to do was just take him down a few pegs, weaken his power. They didn't have anybody to replace him with in the regime change. That was why Condoleezza Rice ended up making the deal and letting them take over the government. That had been their plan all along. To kill, it turns out, nearly 500,000 people. Create a massive war. And, you know, a lot of it was the weather's fault. But the entire Horn of Africa was hit with the drought in 10 and 11, and it was Somalia where 500,000 people starved to death, most of them children, of course, because the war had destroyed their society. All of their markets were completely broken, and they overthrew a guy that they meant to keep. The whole thing was for absolutely nothing. And Al-Shabaab went from the smallest, least significant part of the government that they overthrew to now, to this day, still a powerful resistance movement to the government they ended up compromising with, that these guys have remained opposed to. Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey guys. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, guess what? Peter Van Buren's going to be back on the show too. Talk about his Fourth Amendment article. It is real good. So that's three. Peter Van Buren, Ray McGovern, Adam Morrow today on the show. All right, if you want to know about Somalia, I wrote the single best article that anybody ever wrote about it for the future freedom. And it's there at fff.org. And so just type in Scott Horton Somalia, it'll come right up. Damn, now I can't even remember the exact title of it. Let me see here. Scott Horton Somalia. U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. And by the way, the aforementioned Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book Dirty Wars, he also wrote two articles. If you don't want to read the book, he wrote two really good articles for The Nation. One of them is called Blowback in Somalia. And he really has, I think in one really tight, badass paragraph, he explains, first America did this, and then this, and that, and that's how we got to the terrible place we are today, kind of a thing. Like, he just really makes it perfect. In there, and he goes on a little bit with the narrative about being there too, but it's all right. Skip ahead and get to the part where he really tells the story. It's really great. Blowback in Somalia, and then the other one is called The CIA's Secret Sites in Somalia, and that's how, yeah, back in, when did he write that? 2010, 2011, maybe? There's the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command in Mogadishu with a secret dungeon underground, where people are lawlessly held and tormented. And, you know, Eli Lake, who I normally would not listen to at all, in what I thought was kind of out of character for him, said, hey, you know, I'm here to report to you. I found a secret prison up in Puntland in the north of Somalia that I forget how tightly he connected it to the CIA and or the Joint Special Operations Command. But I think that was in there too. And he made it clear he was talking about a different prison than Scahill had previously reported. So, you know, Scahill says so, take it to the bank. Eli Lake says so, that's a strong indication. Because of, you know, it would typically be against his incentive to break a story like that, I would think, right? That's why it's one of those, even though it's by him, it confirms my bias. So I think it's, yeah, I don't know. I give it at least a good likelihood that there's a second prison run, you know, with the help of the United States, at least in Somalia, too. That Reuters piece is hilarious for its omission. For the ignorance of the right, you can tell they really had no idea. Well, we talked to one anonymous source who said they've been screwing around there, you know, a little bit since 07. We did not bother to go back and read Reuters' own articles from that time to even see if we ever heard of such a thing before or not. It was on the front page of the Washington Post. Bush has Ethiopia invade Somalia. Helps. CIA, military, killing people, kidnapping people, renditioning them to be tortured in Ethiopia. This made the paper back then, guys. For a little while. And the thing is about the hundreds of thousands starving to death, that's a real thing. And it's a real, you know, those are individual human beings, man. You got to stop for a second, you know? Somebody play a needle scratching off a record. Hey, man, there was a terrible famine and 500,000 people starved to death, most of them children under 5 years old. And that's according to the American and British financed FuseNet study. There was a terrible drought on the Horn of Africa, and yet Somalia was a society that had been turned upside down by American intervention. Anyone who was lucky enough to harvest a crop still had no way to get it to market. There was no market, and they had no way to sell it to anybody. There was no money. The division of labor, the division of the economy was completely destroyed by America's war there. And so there were crops being harvested in some places in a much more limited fashion than before. But the entire price structure, the entire distribution structure, the entire whatever economy they had there had been completely obliterated. And America sent in the Ethiopians, who are Christians, against Muslim Somalia. They have historical grievances going back to who cares when, right? And the Ethiopians went in there and they tortured people and they raped women and they murdered people and they committed mass war crimes, acting as nothing but the 4th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army. Acting under orders from the American Empire. Destroyed that place. And then the Al-Shabaab militia, like I say, they came from nothing to be powerful enough to kick the Ethiopians out. And then, yeah, they're a bunch of wannabe Al-Qaeda guys, and they got themselves kicked out of Mogadishu by the people there because they pushed their luck, as Al-Qaeda kooks often do. They were 10 times as bad as the Islamic Courts Union that they were helping resist the Ethiopians, that they came to end up kind of supplanting. The Islamic Courts Union was run by a bunch of old men. Al-Shabaab, they're the fighting age males. That's what it means, the youth. They're the ones who picked up rifles to fight the Ethiopians. And that's how they got as powerful as they ever became. They ended up ruling a lot of Mogadishu for a time there. They're on the run now, but then, so Obama's going to fix that, right? Put more Americans on the ground there and generate that much more blowback and that much more support for those who would kick the foreigners out of the country. Imagine that, too. They got the Ethiopians, the Kenyans, Burundi, Uganda, and Djibouti now, too. They have ground troops there, too. What? Just to steal a little something? Djibouti is nothing but, an American air base and some captives. They have an army? Who knew they had an army? Half a million, elderly children starved to death on the side of the road because of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. That's simple as that. I mean, if you got to boil it down, that's who is ultimately responsible. The buck stops at the Oval Office. And in case you're turning in late, no, not because something bad happened and America didn't help, because America caused the bad thing to happen. Like most of the time. And, if anyone in America cared about someone, there's some kind of magic potion that you could, put in the water supply. This is not a threat, it's just a fantasy. There's some magic potion you could make Americans care at all about Somalis for a minute and know the truth about what their government had done here. Just think about the outrage. But anyway, no one cares. No one tells the truth about it because no one cares to even know the truth about it. And they die in ditches on the side of the road. That's the thing, man. That's the outrage to me. Apart from the murder, is the discrepancy between the level of violence and the level of even acknowledgement on the part of those most responsible for committing it. That's just not fair. Think about your kid starves to death at the hands of some foreign country's intervention in yours. The complete and total deprivation brought on by their repeated regime changes. And the people back in the home country destroying your entire life, they don't even know. They're not even interested enough to know what their government has done to you. Could you imagine that? Well, that's just not fair. I mean, fine, war's not supposed to be fair. Kill them all. But at least acknowledge the people you're killing, for Christ's sake. How corrupt is the American Empire now, where Americans don't even acknowledge the countries their government is at war with? They hand the leak right over to Reuters. Hey, Reuters, here's an exclusive. We're in Somalia, 120 guys right now, and Reuters reports it as America goes back to Somalia for the first time since 1993. Okay. It just doesn't seem fair to me, Reuters, people.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, it's a long break, but it's worth the wait, wouldn't it? Peter Van Buren coming up on the Fourth Amendment. Jody Evans from Code Pink is going to be on to talk about what the hell we're doing about this Iraq war breaking out. And then Ray McGovern on the Empire's intervention in Ukraine. And Adam Morrow on the sock puppet dictatorship in Egypt's first year. All right. Hey, I need money. So what you should do is you should either donate, which would be great. You can sign up for monthly donations or single donations. PayPal is obviously the easiest thing. But if you just go to scotthorton.org/donate, you can find out all about that. You can sign up to do a monthly subscription where you do 5 or 10 or 20 bucks or however you like to do it, even more. If you donate 100 bucks or more, like you hear on the spot, you get a silver commodity disc. Speaking of which, I owe one guy one commodity disc now that I think about it. I better take care of that. Yeah, anyway, but you'll get yours, I swear. I'm really good about it. And I take bitcoins, too. Say you got, I don't know, a bunch of bitcoins that you just don't want anymore. And you want me to have them. You just go and find out my bitcoin address right there at scotthorton.org/donate. More importantly, you can also find out my contact information there at scotthorton.org/donate if you want to advertise on the show. I need advertisers. The more advertisers I have, the less begging for donations I need to do. And you guys can tell, I think everybody knows, right? I only just need to barely make it to zero. And that's not really true. I need much more than that. But whatever. I'm only motivated to make it to zero. If I'm not actually, you know, gonna get the water turned off, I don't usually say anything. But if I was you, I wouldn't want to hear me say anything at all. So if I was you, what I would do is advertise on the show. And then that way I won't need donations. I'll just have advertisers. And so if you have a business or you have a nonprofit type of thing, just drop me an email, scott@scotthorton.org. And maybe we can work out a thing where I help you make money doing the thing that you do. You know how it is. Okay, good. All right, now, there was another FBI entrapment. I mean, they admit the way they cover it on CNN is they say, well, she said all these inflammatory things to an undercover FBI. That's all you need to know. Doesn't matter if it's agent or informant or what. An undercover. You had me at under. She wasn't a criminal. In fact, they even quote her saying, well, I can't do anything. I don't have the means, the motive, the opportunity, nothing. I mean, she might as well have said, I guess if you're a cop and you want to work really hard on setting me up, you can get me to go along with you. I mean, that was basically it. I'm just some bum over here. How am I supposed to be a terrorist? She asked her FBI interlocutor who responded, I can think of some ways. Oh, I'm so scared. Meanwhile, there are going to be real terrorist attacks, and they're going to blame everybody but the FBI, who is so busy entrapping innocent people that they don't do a thing about the next major terrorist attack. And, you know, three died in Boston, and that's a huge deal to those three family members. And, of course, a lot of people were wounded, a lot of them pretty badly. And psychologically speaking, yeah, might as well have been 30 people or 300, right? I don't know. It wasn't quite as big as, say, the Oklahoma bombing or something like that. But still, this is a pretty shocking thing to have the Boston Marathon bombed. Somebody could do that again. The American government does nothing but make enemies for the American people all day long. People are going to be trying to do things like that. And the cops are going to be too busy entrapping some idiot into claiming that, oh, yeah, I love Osama. Just give me my $20,000 you promised me, my new best friend in the world who turns out to be an FBI informant. And is anybody falling for this anymore? I guess the FBI bosses like it. Hey, we got on TV again, Tim. Good job, Johnny. But it seems like even for the long term, they say the FBI cares about nothing more than their reputation. But aren't they gaining the reputation right now of being nothing but a bunch of clowns? And guys, don't come and kill me. It's not because I say that. I'm just perceiving. I'm the mirror here in the media. I'm just saying it's pretty obvious to me that you seem like a bunch of clowns going around and trapping innocent nobodies into saying they love Osama for you. The whole thing is stupid, and you guys are liars, and everyone can see right through you. It's ridiculous. They care about nothing but their reputation. That's like Israel. We care about nothing but our reputation, but I got a great idea, guys. Let's pretend for a week to not know that these three kidnapped teenagers have already been killed so that we can just exploit this thing and whip up a bunch of sentiment and... God, really, guys? You might get a reputation as being horrible people who no one could possibly support if you go around doing stuff like that all the time. Boy, you FBI guys, you better get some new comic books made. Some new G-Man shows for TV about what heroes y'all are. Because from here, it looks like you don't do anything all day except entrap innocent people while real people are trying to bomb Times Square and trying to bomb the Boston Marathon. Pathetic clowns. That's what you are. You're the sad clowns. Everybody points and laughs at in a ha-ha mean way. Ha-ha. It's disgusting. Some idiot lady was successfully entrapped today in Colorado. Big deal. Next news story. Cross that one off the list. Oh, I gotta talk about Iraq because I don't have any Iraq interviews coming up. I'm almost out of time. I think we're still at the point. I don't know. I should check all the latest or headlines at antiwar.com before I get ahead of myself here. I think we're at sort of a lull in the Iraq crisis as everybody is still kind of getting their act together and preparing for the worst to break out. I'm not trying to predict the worst, you know. I don't know. I mean, hundreds of people are dying. I guess there's still a fight going on for to Crete. But everybody's just arming up, right? Iran and Russia are arming up the Iraqi side. America's arming up the Baghdad side against ISIS. Arming up ISIS's allies against Assad in Syria, of course, still. But then, I will fill this gap with something that you need to know. I mention this from time to time, but my friend Nick, he mentioned to me, you know, this is really worth rereading, dude, if you haven't read it in a while. And I thought, yeah, you know, I should. I link to this all the time. I mention it all the time. How Ahmed Chalabi conned the neocons. And this is from 04. This is from 10 years ago. This is from 1 year into the war. Just 1 year into the war. It's by John Desard, who now writes for the Financial Times. He's at Salon.com, and Salon.com has been way cheapened since then. They used to actually produce journalism for a while. How Ahmed Chalabi conned the neocons. And this is so good. It's got some hilarious quotes in here. And I only realize now how long it's been since I read this. And I completely forgot that some of the best quotes at the beginning come from Mark Zell. Who is Mark Zell, Scott? Mark Zell is the law partner of Douglas Feith, the head of the Office of Special Plans, who was the, Abram Schulsky was, but he was the boss of that. He was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy and Richard Perle's right-hand man in the Pentagon and Wolfowitz, working for those two in the Pentagon in charge of lying us into war with Iraq. If you just search Office of Special Plans now that the dust has settled, you will only find the best articles. You'll find Jim Loeb. You'll find two by Seymour Hersh. You'll find two or three by Robert Dreyfus. You'll find Jason Leopold, and you'll probably find my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna. You'll find Senate reports on the Office of Special Plans. Huge deal. And anyway, so the quotes are from Mark Zell about how Ahmed Chalabi is a treacherous, spineless turncoat, about how he promised them the Iraq War was going to be good for Israel, and how it ended up being good for Iran instead. And I was only two-thirds of the way through this thing. It's full of great quotes in here. It's hilarious. You got to read it. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, I know, it's oftentimes easier to make everything on purpose. I think, here's my theory about, the horror that was the Iraq occupation. It seems to me like, all the chaos at most planned was Plan B. I think mostly represents a gigantic failure. I think this article really encapsulates it here. Here's a guy, here's Ahmed Chalabi, who is now one of Iran's nominees for new prime minister of Iraq. Believe it or not, you may have seen this in the media. Here, Salon.com 10 years ago interviewed his nephew, Ali Alawi. And I don't think this is not Iyad Alawi. This is somebody else entirely. He says, we have a lot of problems in common with Iran. If we could resolve them and involve them in a regional security agreement with us, that'd be very fruitful. And this is what's got the neocons. It's 10 years ago now. The neocons completely flipping their lid. They can't believe that Chalabi promised them everything and that he would be a sock puppet of America and Israel is turning toward Iran like this. They're completely besides themselves. So here's his nephew saying, quote, I was worried that he was going to do business with the Zionists. This isn't his nephew. This is someone else. This is Mohd Assad, the managing director of the Amman, Jordan-based International Investment Arabian Group, an industrial agricultural exporter, who is one of Chalabi's Palestinian friends and business partners. So I was worried he was going to do business with the Zionists, he says. He, that is Chalabi, told me not to worry. He just needed the Jews in order to get what he wanted from Washington, and that he would turn on them after that. There you go. Simple as that. And by the Jews, he meant the neoconservatives, which is, I don't know, 0.00000000001% of Jews, even in America, never mind in the world. But what he meant was Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, David Wurmser, Scooter Libby, Stephen Hadley. These guys had to believe. Oh, and they believed. John Bolton, he's not really a neocon, but he runs around with them. And they fell for it completely. Oh, we're going to build, and you hear me say this from time to time, it's been a while since I reread the thing. We're going to build an oil and a water pipeline to Haifa. We're going to, people of Iraq will greet us as liberators, and they'll just let the Americans and, you know, do whatever they want. The Iraqi Shia will be so grateful that they'll be loyal American sock puppets and then help put all this pressure on Iran to come to terms, to come to Israel's terms. And then what happened was that was all ridiculous. Here's Robert Baer. Chalabi has no use for Israel. He knew all along that this was a non-starter. Chalabi knows exactly what Israel stands for in Iraq and in Iran, with or without Saddam. The idea of building the pipeline to Haifa, a rapprochement with Iran. I'm sure he told the neocons these things could happen, that he played to their prejudices and said this is the new Middle East, but he didn't believe any of it. That's the way Chalabi operates. He was willing to ally with anyone to get where he is now, whether it was the neocons, the Israelis, or the Iranians, adds Baer. He wanted back into Iraq, and nothing was going to stop him. And of course, well, hey, INC headquarters was in Tehran. You know, our friend James Bamford, expert on the NSA, also did some pieces for Rolling Stone in the Bush years, including one called The Man Who Sold the War, all about John Rendon and the Rendon Group, PR guys who've been lying us into war since Panama. And, yeah, sorry, I was distracted for a second there. And anyway, yeah, what was I going to say? Somewhere in here, well, didn't he promise them a Hashemite king like in Jordan? Isn't the Jordanian king the last of the Hashemites? I'm talking out of my hat, boys. I don't know. I think so. And anyway, oh, I know what I was going to say. Yeah, see, the Hashemites, they're going to give him a Hashemite kingdom. It's in here. I thought so. Like I said, I hadn't even reread the whole thing yet. It's how Chalabi conned the neocons. And then here's the thing. He got busted not only for telling the Iranians that the Americans had broken their codes. He was also busted on the line, tapped on the line by the NSA, telling the Iranians that the Americans, what Americans' plans were in Iraq, who they were leaning toward, and this kind of thing. What? And then, so the CIA and the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency, they put together a report saying that Chalabi was used by Iran, was an Iranian agent used to lie to the neocons to trick them into invading Iraq and getting rid of Saddam Hussein for them. These guys are going crazy, and they gotta bomb somebody. Let's have them get rid of Saddam for us instead of having them come to Tehran. And so Chalabi wasn't used in Iran. They had a perfect understanding. It was the neocons, and then therefore the neocons, masters Ariel Sharon, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, and George W. Bush, who were the ones who were being used. Agents of influence. That's Robert Dreyfus on the Office of Special Plans. Agents of influence. These guys worked for Ariel Sharon. They thought they'd be helping Israel. And people say, hey, well, at least they smashed Iraq into three pieces, and that was always part of the Yanan plan going way back and that kind of thing. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that's mostly a result of the absolute failure of the Americans to ever get a handle on what the hell was going on in Iraq. They never really were the ones driving the politics in Iraq the whole time they were there. I mean, they were favoring the Supreme Islamic Council over the Sadrists, for example, but were they the ones deciding that the Shiites were going to take Baghdad? No, the leaders of the Shiite parties were the ones who decided they were going to take Baghdad. And there was nothing the Americans could have done to stop them short of starting the war all over again against the South. So instead they fought it for them. The whole thing was a fait accompli in March 03. Sorry, I didn't mean to rhyme, but that's just how it goes. And so there you go, how Ahmed Chalabi conned the neocons. And so, you know, I was saying, I can't believe it that Chalabi's coming back in here the other day on the show, last Friday on the show, to Mitchell Prothero. And Mitchell Prothero said, hey, he always was Iran's man. Uh-huh. That's what I've been trying to tell y'all. You know, the great blogger Bill Mann, who you can still follow him on Twitter, and I don't know who he is, but the guy's pretty smart for a damn Democrat. And he had a blog entry in January of 2005, right after the election, called Ayatollah Yuso, about how this whole thing has been the neocons, the Americans, used by Iran, with Chalabi and Abdulaziz al-Hakim as their lead agents. These are two of the front runners now. Hakim's man, al-Mahdi, and Chalabi are now two of the front runners to replace Maliki from the Dawa Party in our next regime change for Iran there. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got some breaking news here, which is that Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just gave a statement to the Congress or somebody kind of thing. And it's summed up by Yahoo News here that Iraq forces likely need help to regain territory. Well, I think they just changed it. I thought it just said unlikely to regain territory. Now it's emphasis is on how we're going to have to help them do it. But anyway, it sounded like I asked Eric Garrison. He was saying in the chat room that, you know, they're obviously they have sent helicopters and drones and all that. I'm not playing that down. But they're not talking very tough at all. Maybe that's just cover for the escalation as it goes. But it sounds like, in other words, they're trying to be very noncommittal about, he says, Dempsey said, Garris says that, Dempsey says that ISIS could be a threat to the U.S., and then we might have to do more, but we're not there yet. Well, that is music to my ears. Even if he doesn't mean it, well, I'd prefer he means it. But the fact that they're even spinning it that way is means that things could be worse, I guess. I don't know. That's as optimistic as I get, all right? Be happy with that. Okay. Now to our friend Peter Van Buren, formerly with the U.S. State Department. He's the author of the book, We Meant Well. He was part of the attempted reconstruction of Iraq there in the later part of the occupation. And a whistleblower and a writer for TomDispatch.com. And his latest at Tom Dispatch is part two of his series on what we've lost since 9/11. The first part was all about the First Amendment. And this one is all about the fourth. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Peter?
Scott, it's always a pleasure to be back with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us today. Shredding the Fourth Amendment in Post-Constitutional America. This article, again, it's at TomDispatch.com. It also ran under Tom Englehart's name at Antiwar.com. You can find them in the archives there on the right side of the page. And anyway, four ways it no longer applies. Please do tell.
Basically, since 9/11, we have seen a steady dissolution of our rights as Americans as spelled out in the Fourth Amendment. It's a quick reminder that the Bill of Rights, the Fourth, including the Fourth Amendment, were written in specific response to the ultra-powerful executive of the Founding Fathers' Day, the King of England. And as we approach the July 4th holiday, it's important to remember that. It's important to remember why we have, in fact, created this Bill of Rights. Now, fast forward to 2014, and we're seeing that all go away, as if someone had gone to the National Archives in Washington with a big pair of scissors, clipped the Fourth Amendment out of the copy of the Constitution preserved there, crumpled it up, and thrown it away. And typically, this takes the form of the NSA and the almost daily revelations that are coming out about the dragnet surveillance of American citizens, in particular, the surveillance of Americans' online and electronic lives. Bill Binney, an NSA whistleblower, and Tom Drake, another heroic NSA whistleblower, are currently testifying in Germany to the German parliament. And they have revealed just today with the help of some German journalists that the NSA is particularly targeting in their surveillance people who use the Tor service, a way of gaining some anonymity online, and essentially sorting Americans into two piles, those who appear to have knowledge and capability to protect their privacy, who will be monitored, and those who don't.
Who may also be monitored,
but will take almost no effort by the NSA to do so. This is an affront to the Fourth Amendment. One of the key parts of the Fourth Amendment is the concept of reasonable and unreasonable searches. This has been defined over the years, but reasonable searches, in most instances, are exactly what they sound like. The police officer arrests you, will pretend for a legitimate reason, and he or she can search your backpack to make sure you're not carrying a weapon. That's a reasonable search. For searches that don't fall under that category, the Constitution requires a warrant. And a warrant is a specific permission from a court to the police or other law enforcement to search something. And this warrant is supposed to have been issued based on some evidence. The cops just can't say, Scott Horton, don't like the length of his hair, let's search his apartment. No, it's supposed to be based on evidence and information to suggest that a crime has been committed by you, Scott Horton, and that evidence of that crime is likely to be in your apartment. And they have to show that they're going to search for that and not anything else. It's not a license to go hunting through your life. The definition of all that is called probable cause. We've heard these terms on TV and cop shows and things like that. The NSA has turned the Fourth Amendment in circles. They search everyone, everywhere, all the time, without any justification, without any probable cause, without any suspicion, and label it all as, quote, reasonable, and therefore there's no need to warrant that search. In particular, the NSA has taken advantage of several loopholes, if you will, and I'll leave it to everyone to decide whether they were listed in the Patriot Act accidentally or quite purposely. But the most significant of which for the Fourth Amendment today is Section 702. Section 702, which was just revalidated yesterday by one of the White House's many pretend privacy board reviews, mm-hmm. says that the NSA can gather up foreigners' communications pretty much any way they want. What happens, however, is that many foreigners' communications crisscross through the United States or involve an American person. In other words, your friend in Germany calls you up, Scott, and the NSA is, quote-unquote, legally allowed to collect that German person's phone call, but they also scoop up your stuff at the same time. You're in the conversation. This gives them a backdoor to spy on Americans in a warrantless way without any oversight, without anyone having to say, it's okay to do this, it's not okay to do that, without the NSA having to say, hey, we've got a good reason to spy on Scott Horton, but no reason to spy on Peter Van Buren, so we've got to leave him alone, if only that was true. These things collectively have negated Americans' privacy. The alternatives that you have as an American really are slim to none. I mean, I guess you could withdraw from society, live in a cabin up in the woods somehow. But otherwise, what can you do?
Well, and the thing of it is, too, is they've been shown to just turn this stuff over to federal police or state police or local police whenever they want and order a parallel construction job. Exactly. Just make up the reason that you figured this out in the first place and go ahead. Exactly. So you can imagine those gloves coming further off where, screw it, the NSA can just turn over their entire catch on the American people to all the local and state police departments, and then we live in worse slavery than anyone ever in history.
And to make clear what parallel construction is, because it fits hand in glove with these attacks on our privacy rights. So the NSA is out there scooping up everything. And in the course of allegedly looking for terrorists, they happen to find out that John Smith over there smokes a little dope. Well, why not get that information to the local police in a way that the local police don't necessarily know it came from the NSA monitoring John Smith's phone calls, because the NSA doesn't want to get involved. And the truth be told, the police don't want to know the NSA was involved. They pass the information anonymously. The cops go over, kick in a door.
That's our nightmare future right there. I'm sorry, we're all out of time. You got to go and I got to go. But thank you so much, Peter. It's a great article. Everybody look it up. TomDispatch.com. Peter Van Buren on the Fourth Amendment. Sorry for the short segment, but what are you going to do? Thanks again, Peter.
Pleasure.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. A little bit of a technical difficulty there with the Liberty Radio Network, but should be all fixed now. Coming up, Ray McGovern on Ukraine and Adam Morrow, live from Cairo, Egypt, on the year anniversary of the counter-revolution there. Right now we go to Jody Evans from Code Pink. Welcome to the show, Jody. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show here. And so now, of course, the big news is intervention in Iraq. 300 advisors has already turned into as many as 800 Army and Marines. Apparently, some of them will be flying helicopters and will be doing some fighting and combat forces, even according to the government official, quote-unquote combat forces being dispatched now to Iraq. And so looks like we're already headed down that slippery slope. And I just wonder, can you please tell us what we're going to do about it? I mean, I want to help. I ain't pointing fingers. I'm just curious. I know it's hard when Democrats are in power to get liberals really excited about this kind of thing, but we really don't want another Iraq war.
Nope, I'm going to actually tell you, I have never seen the progressive movement come together so quickly. It was dizzying.
Yeah?
Yes, and it was so heartening. That,
okay, tell me all the good news. I'll be quiet.
I can explain, like from when we were out there all alone, I guess Code Pink outside the White House in 03, to, putting our camp up to stop Syria bombing and being the only ones out there and then having people join us after. On this one, we watched Move On, Credo, every organization be out and say no right away. We watched 70 members of Congress come together in a matter of days on a bill that Obama has to come to Congress for authorization for Iraq, just like he did for Syria. It moved through so fast. So it was not only in Congress, it was outside. We've put together a rapid response team all across the country. When it looks like something's starting to move, that we're out there. We're already right now. My team is outside the White House on drones. They're, what we get from inside the White House.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. I meant to say that I know you guys at Code Pink are always hardcore, no matter what. But I am pleasantly surprised to learn the rest.
Yeah. I mean, Phyllis Bennis from Institute for Policy Studies has been on with all the organizations working on talking points. Everybody's on the same line. I have never felt this in the last 12 years, and it's so heartening. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to be able to stop the White House, but the fact that the progressive movement, even with a Democrat in the White House, is just know that everybody over this last 12 years gets war is not the answer. We have messed this place up. We have to stop now. Right. And that you've got 70 members of Congress that came together lightning fast. They know. I haven't seen that happen.
Yeah, that's great.
The other thing we're working on at Code Pink, besides being outside the White House every day, besides working in Congress and going to protest at the different offices of people calling for war, like we've been protesting at McCain's office every day, we've put together a coalition of young people who are writing a proclamation that they're going to each one of these members' offices that want to go to war and protesting at those offices. But the other side of that is, for the last few weeks, we've really been using this as an opportunity to remind everyone why this is happening, what the Bush administration did, how they lied into a war. We've pulled Ambassador Wilson out to start talking. Different people who can tell the story of what happened before, including Mahdi and myself, who went to Iraq right before we invaded, who knew it was wrong, all the people that marched. We're trying to get that story out as much as possible.
Right.
And right now we have the only lawsuit, not only nationally but globally, against the Bush administration that's moving forward. It's out of a San Francisco federal court. You can look it up at the Code Pink website under our Justice for All campaign. We're very excited about this. I went to the Iraq Tribunal in Brussels with Inder Komer, who's the attorney on this, and it just inspired everyone. Matter of fact, it inspired some of the countries representing the coalition, the willing to go back and sue the U.S. and the Bush administration for lying them into the coalition, the willing, and the expenses they incurred for that. So, there's a lot happening in both ways, both, pushing back on the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And, until I take my last breath, I'm going to work to bring the Bush administration to justice. And this case that we've got is amazing. It's on the Nuremberg trial. And there was, the judge said, are you willing to drink from this poison chalice? which is to be held accountable to the same scrutiny that we've held Germany accountable to, and we failed on all counts. The Bush administration has.
Well, now, so, on the current crisis, Jody, let me ask you, is there a big demonstration plan that where all different groups are going to show up with all their membership, hopefully?
Well, that's what I said. We have this rapid response team ready. Right now, it's like you don't want to pull it out before you've really got the mass and they can see what the target is. And so that's what we've been working on in Congress, is to get this bill forward. Right. And so that there can be this bill that says you have to come to Congress without authorization. As soon as that got through, then we could say that Obama has violated his, you know, his Congress, and then we could be in the streets. But we still, everything's still kind of, he's pussyfooting around. And until you can actually have a target, it's hard to get really a mass of people out. And we want to have that mass. So if you go to the codepink.org, we have a petition you can sign. As soon as all the organizations are moving together, and that's Move On, Credo, Avaaz, some of us, I mean, every One Without, all the coalition members of One Without War.
But we could target the president and the Congress at the same time, right? And just say, stay out of Iraq in general. And hey, by the way, Congress, you do something about it. Right.
Right. That's what we're doing. Yeah. And we're in the halls of Congress every we've been in the halls of Congress every day.
But I mean, we could have a giant demonstration at the White House saying you've already sent helicopters. You've already sent 800 guys. And that's 800 too many.
Well,
turn
and
around.
Right now, the thing you need to do is look on the Rigel Lee bill and see how many signatures they have. Make sure your member of Congress is on
right.
there. If they're not,
right. I'm with
pour calls into that member's office. Right now, it's really, we have a stopgap. We could get Congress to authorize no war like they did with Syria. They
By the
know
way, Jody, is are any of the Ron Paul Republicans supporting this at all, Massey or Amash?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to look at the list myself.
Right.
I basically know that I have more pull with Democrats, so that's where I target
sure.
myself.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
I let the Republicans work on their own. The only thing we do with Republicans is go after them for saying war's the answer here, and
right.
they should know better. But you should know that, like, all the members' offices that we've been in, they're getting 99% calls again that, you know, don't go there, don't
right.
go there. So... You know, what we need to do, and when you're making the calls too, is we need to stop thinking that military weapons and war are the answer to this. And, you know, no more weapon sales. It's disgusting that Kerry has is giving weapons to Egypt again while they're violating everyone's human rights there. I mean, what they're doing in Egypt is insane. And the fact that Kerry goes there and recognizes the government and then decides to give them weapons and money again is just... And we're making this mess, and we have to keep holding our leaders accountable to it.
Yeah, well, and in this specific case, there's a great case to be made that they're more or less at stalemate. That doesn't mean there's not going to be more fighting. They're more or less at stalemate right now, and if we just dump a bunch of arms in there, then we throw the balance back into violence.
Well, and, you know, when I was in Iraq before we invaded, the Iraqis just said, please leave us alone, you know? And when did we become the policemen of the world? And haven't we yet looked in the mirror of that arrogance and seen the disasters we're creating?
Right. Yeah, you know, I have to admit, I'm pleasantly surprised even in the media coverage of people saying, geez, I don't know. I think we kind of have to admit that it's sort of the invasion of 03's fault that all this is going on and that kind of thing. And of course, you know, the McCains are always still going to attack from the right as loud as they can. But so we need a really big noise from the peace movement so that it's made clear to those with power that the real politics on this are that the American people, who are the ones with the votes, are dead set against this. And they better not. In fact, they better get out in front of our parade before it runs them over. You know, they better get out in front of it to lead it before it runs them over. Yeah. You know?
So right now, keep those calls coming. Sign every petition you can, because then you'll be in the loop for the rapid response.
Yep. All right. Thank you so much for your efforts and for your time on the show today, Jody. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
That's Jody Evans, everybody, from Code Pink. The website is CodePink4Peace, the number 4Peace, or just search Code Pink, and they have all of their actions and media alerts and all the ways that you can participate there on the website. And I do hope that people will call their congressman. And yes, I know that in some circumstances it can be futile or worse to do so. And I'm a libertarian anarchist, and I ain't got much respect for democracy either. On the other hand, it can matter. There are historical examples of when it really mattered, that the phone just kept ringing and ringing and ringing, and whatever issue it was, the people were against it and got it killed. And Syria last summer is one example. It's worth your time and effort to make some calls. Come on. Get your congressman on board. There's already a thing in Congress, she said. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, formerly with the CIA for 27 years as an analyst. Now a peacenik. Travels around giving speeches about peace. And he writes for consortiumnews.com and at raymcgovern.com. We run virtually everything by him, I think, at antiwar.com as well. The latest is The Risk of a Ukraine Bloodbath, running today at antiwar.com. You can find it again as well at consortiumnews.com. Welcome back, Ray. How are you?
Thank you, Scott. Doing well.
Good, good. Happy to have you here. Welcome back again. Appreciate you keeping up on this very important subject for us. And so tell us about this risk of Ukraine bloodbath. You're saying here that the Americans and the Ukrainians have split off from the Europeans on the issue of negotiation with the East and with Russia. Is that right?
Yeah, it's become very evident in the last days that Poroshenko is really acting as a puppet of John Kerry and Victoria Nuland and the other neoconservatives. And more important, he thumbed his nose at the rulers. I mean, I'm not talking about the foreign ministers now. I'm talking about the rulers of France, of Germany, and of Russia, as they talked on a conference call for 2 hours on Sunday. They did everything they could to dissuade him from attacking the East and the Southeast, and instead renewing the ceasefire arrangement. And he announced very early on Tuesday, nothing doing. He was going to unleash, as he said, he was going to attack, using a very strong Russian Ukrainian word. He's going to attack and free all our lands. And of course, renewal of hostilities happened immediately. So, one of the stories here, which is most interesting, is that the French and the Germans, together with the Russians, have split off from John Kerry and company and joined with the Ukrainian foreign minister. The four foreign ministers met in Berlin yesterday. They appealed for renewal of the ceasefire. I haven't seen any evidence that this has received any resonance in Ukraine. So we're in a situation where the Germans and the French pretty much dismissed the British as a clone of Washington, and have moved together with the Russians, with Sergei Lavrov, their very astute foreign minister, pretty much orchestrating this, and met in Berlin at the invitation of the German foreign minister yesterday, and the Ukrainian foreign minister was a part of that, and mutually agreed upon quadripartite statement called for a renewal of the ceasefire. Now, I don't know how that parses, because, as I say, Poroshenko has unleashed his forces. And if there's a bloodbath, then Nuland and Kerry may get their wish of more open Russian involvement in protecting what they consider to be Russians and pro-Russian citizens in the eastern Ukraine.
And what do they have to gain from that, provoking a worse response from Russia? They already lost Crimea.
Well, you know, that's interesting. They want to make it worse. They want to encourage or trap, or mousetrap, Putin into invading Ukraine. You can imagine the hysteria that the right-wing media in this country would drum up at that point. And eventually, I think the Russians are afraid that they still have designs on Ukraine. Poroshenko has reiterated that Ukraine is still part of, they still have designs on Crimea. Poroshenko has said that Crimea will always be part of Ukraine. And, you know, that's the nub of the problem there. There's a terrifically big warm water port there that the Russians have put their navy in since Catherine the Great back in the late 18th century. As we're going through our own revolution, Russia was extending its rule down to and including the Crimea. So, you know, if the putsch people, the people who took office, and Poroshenko, who was elected several weeks ago, decide that they really want to give the pro-Russian people, the separatists, or the people, separatists really isn't the right word. These are people who were against the coup d'etat on the 22nd of February. The president that they had elected was removed, and they didn't like that. And they took over some of the towns there and still have sway over them. So what we've got is a situation that's very volatile. And if Poroshenko sends his heavy artillery and his aircraft into those parts of the Ukraine and starts obliterating some of the cities there, then it's going to be very, very difficult for Putin to keep his powder dry and not to do something pretty flagrant, all while knowing that that's precisely what Kerry and Nuland and the neocons would like him to do to make things still worse for the Ukraine and still worse for Russian-U.S. relations.
Well, so in other words, the ultimate end still is just making sure America isn't getting along with Russia, although that's a pretty big way to go if they're willing to try to provoke the Russians into invading the East just to make the crisis worse. I mean, are they want to split the country in pieces and just run off with only the West? Is that it? I mean, because after all, they were able to spin Russia's taking of Crimea as the worst thing ever. Look, it's the rise of the USSR and blah, blah, blah. So they already lost the prime real estate that they wanted more than anything else. And they were able to make, you know, PR hay about it, make Russia look like the bad guy about it. Mission accomplished there, I don't think anybody would quibble with, right? But so what's really, I mean, if he invades the East, he might go all the way to Odessa, take the port and all that, and just keep all of eastern Ukraine. If they make things that bad, how do they benefit there?
Well, the Russians wouldn't benefit there either. It's Ukraine is a basket case.
I mean, I could see that. It's hanging a millstone around Russia's neck, making it look like even more their fault since they're making the larger overt move. But it's still, well, and, you know, I don't know, maybe they're stupid and they haven't really thought this through. I mean, we're talking about Robert Kagan's wife, so how bright can she be to be in love with that guy?
Well, there must be some special charm about Robert Kagan that escapes me. But
it's the Cocoa Puff stay-at-home dad thing.
But if you look at the disarray in which U.S. policy is in the Middle East and in Europe, now we have some of our close buddies in Europe, the Germans and the French, asserting some independence for the first time since the war. You know, stupidity, idiot ideology, if you will, can play a big role here. But more important, Ukraine is a basket case economically. It's going to suffer either whether it goes toward the West or to the East. And the big price here is the strategic significance of Ukraine. And of course, still on the books is the summit resolution at Bucharest, a summit of NATO leaders in April of 2008, which said Ukraine will become part of NATO. Now, that's going to be interesting in September when NATO meets again at the summit. They're meeting in Wales. Will they reiterate that desire to have the Ukraine part of NATO? And if so, why? Well, what worries the Russians is if you have that kind of resolution staying in force, then there's a sort of quasi-juridical reason for NATO to keep trying to take back the Crimea, to keep trying to wean Ukraine away from...
All right, I'm sorry, Ray, we got to stop. The bumper music is drowning you out and everything. We got to take this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with the great Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for sanity, which I know is asking a lot, but, you know, we'll try. 1 minute. Okay, 4. Hey, all Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Ray McGovern from consortiumnews.com. We also feature what he writes at antiwar.com. The risk of Ukraine bloodbath is running today. And we're talking about how the Europeans are saying, hey, let's work with the Russians and let's convince the Kiev post-Putsch government to go ahead and come to some kind of settlement here. And the Americans have told the Ukrainians, the Kiev government, don't listen to Germany. Go ahead and keep picking a fight. Keep attacking the East. See if we can bait the Russians into making matters worse here for everyone. And, which, you know, same thing, different day around here, right, Ray? tell me this. What about Yarosh and the right sector neo-Nazi thugs, a.k.a. the National Guard of Ukraine? Who's training them? Who's arming them? How powerful a force are they? And what are they up to now?
Well, tongue-in-cheek, Scott, I'll have to tell you that they're a force for democracy. Because my suspicion is that the endowment, or the new endowment for democracy, some people consider that rightfully so, a successor to the CIA covert action department. They've been arming them and training them in places like Poland and other places that are friendly to this kind of thing for the right amount of remuneration from the United States Treasury. So long-winded answer, to be short, is that, they're fascists. They're trained by people who want to disrupt the Ukrainian government. And the worst part of it is that Russia remembers what fascism is like. Russia remembers what the followers, now the heirs of Stepan Bandera in the Ukraine, what he did in cooperation with Hitler in cleansing the vermin from the Ukraine. And the vermin were not only Jews, in his words, but Russians as well, Poles as well. So there is a recollection among people my age, at least, and maybe even a little younger in Europe, about what fascism is like. And that, I think, is part of why Putin and his very able foreign minister, Lavrov, are appealing to the French and to the Germans, because they know. I mean, they have a not so recent, but very palpable memory of what fascism is like. And they also know what war is like, which is something that even though we've waged war abroad, and even though we suffered 9/11, we don't really know. And so what I see the French and the Germans doing now is saying, look, Newland, relax a little. If you think you can get Crimea back, forget about it. If you think you can get Ukraine into NATO, forget about it. Let's work this thing out without larger scale hostilities. Now, the Russians, for their part, they have the high cards here. I'm sure they're telling the Germans and the French, look, we don't want to do this. But if the Ukrainian forces start bloodying up the cities in Luhansk and Kramatorsk and some of the other places there in the Donbass area, we're going to be compelled to enforce a no-fly zone, shoot planes down, mess up your tanks and so forth. Do you really want that? And so I think that there's a chance that reason may prevail here and Poroshenko will kind of pull back if Washington lets him. The problem is that the fascists, I'm not sure that Poroshenko still has control over these people. They're doing their right sectors, Svoboda, other fascist kinds of units are doing their work in the Ukraine, and it's hard to turn that off once it's turned on. I don't think anybody wants a full-scale conflagration here, but we're talking about the possibility of a real confrontation between the United States of America and Russia for the first time in 25 years. Now, for us, we can have John Kerry, our Secretary of State, saying in answer to the question, they asked him, well, are you aware this could lead to this kind of confrontation? He says, oh, yeah. Oh, we're quite aware of this, that could lead to a large-scale war. We've taken that into account. Well, if that's how blasé he is, if that's how nonchalant he is, then he's even dumber than I thought he was. And the operative thing here is if I'm a Russian, I'm going to take that into account. I'm going to say, wow, we better stop them right now before they go even further in the Ukraine and elsewhere in Europe and even in Asia.
All right, and now how many of these guys are there? Because it seems like, okay, I could see them being, they're the SA, not the SS, right? They can mob some buildings and they can win some street fights, but can they be sent as an actual National Guard force to use real weapons in order to kill lots of people? Or they're still just thugs, basically?
Yeah, but, the Ukrainian army isn't the crackerjack outfit that Kiev would like to make out it is. These thugs, some of them are highly trained. They can be inserted into Ukrainian units and lead them more effectively. And that's what often happens with these kinds of vanguard units.
And they are the National Guard now. That's what they call them, right? And Yurash from Right Sector is the head of it.
Sure, the head of their national security apparatus in Kiev is one of the people who facilitated the coup on the 22nd of February, and he's a well-known fascist. So what I'm saying here is that we don't really know how many there are, but in terms of Ukrainian units in that part of the Ukraine, best figures I've seen are already 10 to 20,000, and that's a lot when you're talking about just one region, the Donbas. And if they're led, or if they're infiltrated, or kind of encouraged by these highly trained dissidents, or not dissidents, but fascists, then you have a more potent fighting force. And the problem is, the challenge for them will be, that we're talking about cities here. We're talking about cities of 1 million, 2 million people. Are you going to go block to block against Ukrainian nationalists, Ukrainian pro-Russians, or Ukrainian who don't want to recognize Kiev? Are you going to try to do that kind of thing and ethnically cleanse? I don't think you want to get involved in that kind of thing, at least if you have any marbles in your head. And so the task itself is formidable, and that's part of what leads me to believe that reason will finally prevail. Poroshenko will be restrained by Washington, and if he can restrain the fascists that have already been let loose, then there could be a ceasefire and meaningful negotiations. That's my hope.
Well, at least the Americans are going to abandon them, if not rein them in. I mean, they've got to see that coming, too. If I was Putin, I would be telling Kiev, look, the Americans are already off chasing kidnapped girls in Nigeria, and they're back to Iraq, and they don't have time for you, and you know it. So come to the table. What are we even fighting about at all right now? It's ridiculous.
That's why I finish up this piece reminding, or suggesting that somebody else remind Poroshenko of the bloody nose that the Russians gave Georgia. That was just, 6 years ago in 2008. That was right after that NATO summit in April of 2008, where it was not only the Ukraine, but also Georgia that was said to be by the NATO summit. We will, the NATO. Saakashvili thought that he could give a bloody nose to the Russians and pro-Russians in the adjoining province. He did so. He got really trummeled by Russian forces, and nobody came to help him. So there's an example of what happens in the end. You're right to adduce that example. The folks in Kiev should be aware of that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for your time, Ray. I sure appreciate it.
Most welcome.
All right, but that's the great Ray McGovern. He's at consortiumnews.com and at antiwar.com today. the risk of a Ukraine bloodbath. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, where I do a show. All right, next up is Adam Morrow. He's a journalist living in Cairo. Reports for Interpress Service, ipsnews.net. And great to have you back on the show. Adam, how are you?
Thanks, Scott. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. It's the 3rd of July, so that makes it then the one-year anniversary of the counter-revolution in Egypt. Let's go ahead. You tell the story of the coup and then what's happened in the last year, and I'll take some notes and try to follow up where I can.
Sure. Well, just starting with what happened today, you had demonstrations across the country of varying sizes. Again, it's difficult to it's always difficult to determine exactly how big these demonstrations are because the only media that covers them really is Al Jazeera, is the Qatar news network Al Jazeera. All the local Egyptian channels will studiously avoid covering them. So again, it's difficult to tell how big the Morsi protests were that we saw today. At least one person was killed. I think pro-Morsi people are saying that there were three deaths at the hands of security forces, but I think officially they're just saying one. That's basically what happened today. Of course, what we saw today wasn't nearly as big as past protests, because you've got tens of thousands of pro-Morsi people are in prison now, and security services tend to immediately start with live ammunition when they break up these protests. So it looks like they were very quickly dispersed. Nothing too big. People were expecting maybe something larger to mark the first anniversary of the coup, but again, you've got tens of thousands in jail, and you've got very, very heavy-handed policing. Seem to have made pretty short work of the planned protests today. And it was 1 year ago today that basically the military stepped in on the back of opposition protests. Egypt's formidable military apparatus stepped in and forcibly removed Mohamed Morsi from office. He had only been in office for 1 year. If you remember, he won 2012 elections. He was removed from office, and he was replaced with an interim government that served until about a month ago, when the army chief who basically spearheaded his removal was elected president in a very, very dubious election, in which he is said to have got 97% of the vote. So now you have Abdel Fattah al-Sisi as president of Egypt, 1 year after the 1 year after removing the democratically elected president from office. It looks like basically what you had before the January 25th, 2011 revolution, you have a very similar situation now. Sort of Egypt is back to square one with an awful economy, a collapsing bureaucracy. The country is completely broke. Tourism is in shambles. And huge, huge segments of the population are very, very frustrated over unemployment and the usual, the sort of chronic unemployment, et cetera. So basically we're back again to where we were in 2010 as of now.
Man. That ain't just the worst shame, Adam. And, those who are maybe new to the show or somewhat new to the show, I've been speaking with Adam Morrow since the Arab Spring broke out back in January. It could have been February of 2011. And, sort of keeping track, mostly through you. I've had some other guests on from time to time about Egypt, but mostly you're my Egypt guy, So as the narrative has unfolded in front of us here, it's just... You know, it's like marching to war in Iraq back in 02 and 03. It's just the slowest motion train wreck. No, man.
Yeah, and just when you get a little bit of hope, you know, after something like January 25th, I mean, there was so much hope, so much euphoria for the future, and which makes it all the more heartbreaking, the way things have turned out. Another very sad aspect of all of this is that in 2011, you really did see a strong popular presence. You know, you really had all strata of society sort of coming out and hitting the streets opposed to Mubarak. Not everybody, of course, not everybody, but large portions of the population coming out. Whereas this time around, when you'd think there would be even more of a reason to demonstrate, you're actually seeing this incredible apathy, which I think is probably the result of, you know, this is something that a big mistake that the so-called revolutionaries made is that the average Egyptian never saw any benefits of the revolution. You know, they saw this revolution happen, they sort of looked askance at it, didn't know what to expect, and then they didn't any benefits accrue to them as a result of it. And for that reason, you know, this time around, people are much more apathetic. You know, people are like, we don't want to go through all of that again. We tried our little experiment with democracy, it didn't work for us. You know, so you've got this very, people are very, very resigned right now, which is also very, it's really tragic. You know, it's sort of like, you know, we had our chance and we just couldn't get our acts together enough and we couldn't work together. And so the status quo has been reimposed on us. And now, you know, there's kind of, you know, this sort of hopelessness that's really, really unfortunate.
Yeah.
But that's what you got.
All right. Well, let me oversimplify some things and you straighten it out. But if I understand your story, basically, it sounds like after the revolution of 2011 and Mubarak being deposed, that you really had three sort of major factions. I guess two of them much bigger than the third. The first two being the state itself, the executive branch and the military and all the judges and all the
deep bureaucrats. State, the so-called deep state.
Yeah. Well, and even the surface one, too. Right. And then you had the Muslim Brotherhood, who was the only, their de facto legal, only real outside group, political group allowed to exist, even though they're officially outlawed. They pretty much, you know, and that's
the
basically
only
the private businessmen
and
that kind of thing, and the religious leaders. And then you had the liberals and the union people and maybe the young and tech savvy, and they were the smallest portion. But then, so what happened was, it was supposed to be the Brotherhood and the young and the liberal who were working together to maintain a democratic system with regular elections and move toward more self-government, less emergency law, less totalitarianism. And their enemy in that was the state. But instead, they fought with each other, and the Muslim Brotherhood wouldn't include the liberals at all, and the liberals refused to have anything to do with the Muslim Brotherhood. And so the military came and said, okay, Muslim Brotherhood, the liberals want us to get rid of you, and so we're getting rid of you. And that was what happened a year ago. Now, I know that ain't quite right, because that's my oversimplification from Texas. But please, you know, quibble with me and help straighten me out here.
No, that is more or less what happened. And another thing, like I was saying earlier about the apathy now, those liberal forces, those so-called liberal forces and revolutionary forces, so much was made in the wake of 2011. So, you know, talk of this new ascendant, Egyptian youth, this internet savvy Facebook youth were leading the road to reform and democracy and all of this stuff. And that whole crowd, that third force that you just mentioned, are nowhere to be seen now. You know, you'd think now more than ever
leaders are in prison, you know, now, right? Just like the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a handful of them. It's not a lot of people, you know, will talk about the government cracking down on the Islamists and the liberal, you know, the liberal leaders of the January 5th revolution. But, I mean, bear in mind, you've got tens of thousands of Islamists locked up. Right. And a handful. I mean, I don't want to give wrong numbers here, but I mean, you can't possibly compare in terms of the numbers of people that are being locked up. Yeah. You can't compare. I mean, again, there are tens of thousands of Islamists who are languishing in prison right now, and you've got horrible stories coming out. You've got allegations of, like, gang rape going on in these prisons. You've got, like, the most horrific stuff you can imagine, which kind of rings true, because I mean, the government is doing like a rabid animal after the terrible the terrible turnout in the last election has made them even more defensive than they were before. So it's really, these people are capable of doing anything to secure their, you know, to secure their authority at this point. So I think they're doing really horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. I know international human rights groups are coming out. I think Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, one or the other just came out and said it. This is like unprecedented decline in human rights in Egypt over the last several, you know, since.
All right, give us a minute, Adam. We got to take this break. Sure. We'll be right back, everybody, with Adam Moore on Egypt. From Egypt, on Egypt. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm on the line with Adam Moro. He's a reporter in Cairo, Egypt. I'm talking about the results of the coup a year ago, the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood government and its replacement by this pretended elected dictatorship of Field Marshal Sisi here. Tell me this, Adam, and lots to go over here. Tell me, what, if any, was the American role in the coup there?
Man, that's a great question, and that's one that definitely needs further research. I mean, they definitely kept themselves very far from it. If there was American involvement, they did a very good job sort of keeping it under wraps. They certainly seemed surprised when it happened. We talked about this a little bit last time, and how it seems like most of the planning and the logistics and the money for the coup last year, or the counter revolution, as you very accurately described it before that, was done. We used the term in-house last time, was done in the region by long-standing allies of the Egyptian deep state, those being specifically Saudi Arabia at the top of the list, mm-hmm. and then the United Arab Emirates as well, which has become increasingly aggressive in its sort of its foreign policy, mm-hmm. and Kuwait to a lesser extent, all of which who have given billions, I think it's something like $20 billion, combined total of $20 billion at this point, into propping up the Egyptian economy, you know, despite all of its, you know, under the all of its post-coup circumstances. Right. You know, again, I mentioned earlier that the tourism industry is destroyed. And that had long been a main foreign currency earner for the country, as well as other sources of revenue have sort of dried up in the last couple of years. So the Gulf states have all stepped in to sort of keep Sisi's Egypt afloat, you know, and yet even despite these huge cash infusions, you still have infrastructure that's literally crumbling in front of your eyes here. I mean, we get between two or three electricity cuts that last about an hour every day, and that's even in upscale areas of the capital, just as an indication of how bad the sort of infrastructure here is and just sort of how poorly everything is going. Everybody's been complaining about that for months. Sisi hasn't been able to fix that. That was one of the main reasons, if you remember, people were running out on the streets to get Morsi out was because his inability to fix the electricity crisis. And yet that has remained unabated. The whole electricity crisis has remained unabated until now. And despite all of the, the Saudi largesse, they still can't seem to get their acts together. And I think the Gulf countries themselves have even told Egypt, they're like, you guys have to get your acts together here because we're not going to funnel money indefinitely. You know, we're not going to just pour. Egypt has become this huge regional money pit that they're just pouring money on top of, you know, just in order to, you know, justify the exclusion of the Islamist trend here. You still with me, Scott?
I'm here, yeah.
Yeah.
And so now, but what about America's military's relationship with the Egyptian
military? Sorry, you talked about America,
military.
And I took it in a totally different direction.
I'm sorry?
I don't know enough about the inner workings of sort of U.S. foreign policy making to know if it's possible that certain segments of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, for example, or even the executive branch, I don't know if they knew about it.
Giraldi was telling us a year and a half ago, so 6 months after the Yeah. 6 months before
the election.
The coup, two years after the revolution. Now I'm losing track.
Right.
Anyway, 6 months before the coup, he was saying the Saudis are bankrolling riots in the streets to destabilize the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I mean, people
actually
came out. So if
Phil knew that, then the CIA was telling him that, and so DC knew that 6 months before, at least.
That's what I figure. They must have known what was going on. You had Ahmed Shafiq, who was Morsi's main competitor in the 2012 polls, who narrowly lost to Morsi in 2012, setting up an operations room in Abu Dhabi. And he was quoted by Reuters or something like that, admitting as much, saying we're sitting here in an operations room coordinating the protests from Abu Dhabi. So, I mean, that stuff's on the record. You had Naguib Sawiris, who was this huge Coptic billionaire. He was incredibly, incredibly anti-Islamist, basically admitting also in a Wire story that he was funding the Tamarid movement. If you remember that, the petition campaign, the anti-Morsi petition campaign that sort of got the whole protest thing going back.
And
in
yet the dictatorship. The current Pharaoh says that America's behind the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh, yeah, that's just transparent crap, though. I mean, that's just, I don't know if anybody's actually buying that.
But that's, it's interesting to note for people who are new at this, that legitimacy comes with denouncing the United States. It's the
exactly.
only way that anybody can get ahead in the world anywhere but here.
In the Middle East, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway,
listen. You had also asked me before. I don't know if you wanted to talk about this. I just wanted to say about in terms of other regional issues that are going on. Crazy stuff going on in Iraq. The stuff going on in Syria with the launch of this caliphate and all of this.
Well, they say there are guys with ISIS flags in the Sinai Peninsula, Adam. What about that?
Well, those black flags had been spotted earlier. That's not a new thing. Those black flags cropped up at some funeral that was held, I think, during Morsi's time. Those black flags cropped up, and everybody made a big deal of them at the time. That was like more than a year ago. So that's not an entirely new thing. But I will tell you, in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood, they've very carefully avoided commenting or issuing statements in support or against any of these foreign movements, any of these big Islamist groups that are cropping up now. They studiously avoided issuing anything like that. So they're sort of staying out of the fray. They're focusing entirely on the domestic issue right now, and they're certainly not issuing any, certainly haven't come out in support of any of the things that are happening in Syria or Iraq recently.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, and they got their own fish to fry right now, especially considering it sounds like you're saying most of them are in prison.
Exactly.
And now, by the way, how many Muslim Brotherhood people have been sentenced to death now?
Oh, it's very difficult to determine because some of them can be appealed and others can't. It's in the hundreds. Yeah. I mean, it's in the hundreds, including the group's number one, Muhammad Badia, who's the supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, has been sentenced to death.
And are there anything to the charges that they did anything other than being the guys that were overthrown?
Oh, no. I mean, they say it's because that they incited violence and they've got a bunch of trumped up charges, which are completely ludicrous. I mean, if you look at the sentencing of the Al Jazeera journalists, that was based on absolutely ludicrous evidence. I mean, there was no evidence that was brought to bear against those three Al Jazeera journalists who were all in prison for something like 7 years each. That was two weeks ago or so.
And now John Kerry's over there still giving them money. And they said, hey, John Kerry, I guess if I read this right, Adam, it was, hey, John Kerry, you just left Egypt where you said they were great. And as your plane was taken off, they announced the conviction of these Al Jazeera guys. And I forgot what I read. He said something about how, well, good, or so what, or something. I mean, what's he going to say?
Listen, I apologize in advance if my phone goes dead, my battery's getting low, but I will just say that the United States vis-a-vis Egypt, even going back to 2011 and before, has always been sort of, has always been sort of, psychotic in that it's got two, it's at one, on one level they want Egypt to remain stable, and they wanted to remain, you know, they wanted to abide by the Camp David peace agreement and be stable, so their Suez Canal will give them access to, you know, the global trade lanes and all of that sort of thing. But at the same time, they also have to talk the democracy talk as well. And so they have to, they always have to support, you know, like, you know, supposedly democratic trends or, you know, democratic transitions, and they have to say bad things about dictators. So you double speak with the U.S. all the time. They're always caught. It's funny. I mean, it sort of came to a head in January 2011 when at one point, you know, they were saying Mubarak is great and he's going to stay and he's not going anywhere. And at the other, you know, and the next day they're lauding the you know, these young Democrats in Tahrir Square. So this back and forth with the United States is nothing new.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting there. I guess they're still sending the weapons, and they're just pretending that the law that says they can't, benefit.
Right. Well, exactly. At the end of the day, I'm sure they're very happy to see Egypt in you know, they don't want to see regular protests and all this protest activity and stuff, but they do want to see a stable Egypt more than anything else. They prefer, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Sisi is just a clone of Mubarak at this point, right? Isn't he?
Say that again?
Isn't Sisi basically just a clone of Mubarak, exactly the kind of guy that they would prefer to have in power there?
Yeah, a lot of people try to say that there are differences and that sort of thing, but at the end of the day, if you look at the people he's appointed, if you look at all the people around him, if you look at his new prime minister, for example, who was a long-standing member of Mubarak's policy secretariat, infamous policy secretariat, all the people around him are from the old regime. So, I mean, again, like you said at the beginning of the show, it was definitely a counter-revolution.
All right, thanks. That's Adam Morrow, everybody. Thanks, Adam.